Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma and I'm Senior Fellow and Chairman at the Institute. I'm today joined by Michal Meiden, who's Director of the China Energy Programme at the OIS, to discuss the key messages and conclusions from the China Day that was held at the Institute at the end of February for members of the OIES China Programme. Michal, great to have you here. Thanks for joining. Let's start by, can you tell us about the OIS China Programme and basically why you decided to hold the China Day at this time?
Sure. Well, thank you for this conversation. We launched the China Programme in the summer of 2019. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sense was that there was a void to fill both in industry and in academia, as there is no global think tank that looks at China and energy and all that that entails. I mean, the macro environment, the market movements, the policy decisions, all of those inform China's energy mix and global trade flows. So each one of those issues is critically important, and so we decided to try and deal with them on an analytical basis, but holistically and in a multidisciplinary fashion.
And of course, your background is Asia and China, isn't it?
Yes, it's China, quite specifically, China and energy. But our research is all publicly available.
Right.
The China Day in itself is really a unique opportunity to gather the programme sponsors, who are all sort of industry leaders, with our research fellows, a select number of experts. We gather in Oxford, we discuss a number of key themes. Now, the decision was to hold it at the end of IP week, which is when the industry typically descends on London. This year, of course, with the coronavirus, there were quite a number of travel restrictions, but we still had a large number of participants that were able to make it.
Great.
And so, adhering, of course, to all the NHS guidelines, we decided to go ahead with it and discuss the both the short-term trends, but also some of the medium-term questions.
And that's what we're going to pick up in today's podcast. So that's great. And I have to say, it was a great success today, so it's fantastic. Well, why don't we start by talking about the state of the China economy? I know it's complicated, and you've mentioned the coronavirus already, but what's it look like?
In a way, the economy is the easy bit of it, because amidst all the uncertainty and the attempts to slow the outbreak of the coronavirus, the Chinese economy virtually shut down. And so we had quarantines and travel restrictions. The economy ground to a halt for the better part of the past 6 weeks. Anything from passenger traffic, freight movement, consumer activities, they're all down anywhere from 50 to 80%
That's
on the 2019 levels. Now, the complicating factor, sort of benchmarking the seasonality, is complicated by the fact that this was just before Chinese New Year. And that is peak travel, peak consumption season. And so for markets, for oil markets, for example, it wasn't just a loss of normal activity. It was the height of gasoline, jet, of travel demand, of consumer goods. For gas, however, it's actually a quieter period as industry, which is the biggest user of gas in China, was offline.
Right. So we saw gas demand actually stayed at the levels you'd expect, but oil demand dropped off considerably, did it, from the levels that you would expect over Chinese New Year?
I mean, over Chinese New Year, gas demand was stable. It was the extended break that then became the hit for gas.
And that was how long?
Well, so it's only, China's only gradually returning to work now, and even now we're getting very different indications. It varies by province.
And now being how far after Chinese New Year?
So we're almost 6 weeks Chinese New Year.
Wow, okay, okay. And the weaker demand also has not only been in China, has it? Because that's had reverberations through the global markets, you know. So will, do you think the short-term effect, you know, have a long-term impact on what's happening?
I mean, it's the short-term impact, of course. You know, when you think about China, then it's a hit to demand in China. It's a hit to imports and kind of global demand of almost every good you can think of. Then it's supply chains. Anything from, you know, your spare parts to your iPhone battery, or your iPad is now delayed. The launch of the next iPhone is delayed. Car parts, construction sector components, the plastic resins that go into plastic water bottles, those are made in China. Manufacturers don't necessarily even know which bits, even the smallest bits of their supply chain might come from China. And that's now having a lag effect on supply chains globally. But the third element, of course, is sentiment and the impact on financial markets.
Yeah.
And now that the coronavirus is a pandemic, we're seeing, you know, the Dow Jones and the stock markets in their biggest bear territory in over 10 years.
Yeah.
So really what started off as, I think people were thinking this is China, maybe it will be contained, now really it's having a much bigger impact.
Yeah, and we're calling this just so people know on the 12th of March, which I think is quite important to have a date time, isn't it? Because who knows what's going to happen on the 13th and the 14th?
Yes.
But you know, it's the day on which the US has just announced that they will be banning flights from Europe, so you can put that into your kind of timeline. So there's a short-term impact happening, obviously, but okay. Let's be optimistic. Let's move to the future. And you know, what are the Chinese government doing to reinvigorate the economy?
Well, that really is, now they're trying to get everybody back to work and offering support measures for enterprises, for ports, for, you know, de-bottlenecking a lot of the logistical frameworks that have come to a halt. But there's a very difficult trade-off for local officials, and on the one hand, they're being told you need growth and they're trying to spur that growth. But on the other hand, they don't want their contagion numbers to rise again. And so they have to limit the flow of people. So you're getting a bit of a push and pull. But of course, at the beginning of 2020, this was supposed to be a really good year, because this is the year that China has promised to double per capita GDP from 2010 levels. The sense was that that would mean 5.6 or 6% GDP growth, and that was well within reach before the coronavirus
hit. In fact, actually, it was well within, because we were looking kind of 8, 10, 12%, weren't we, in previous years?
Historically,
yeah,
yes.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, I mean, Q4 was 6%. Mm-hmm. The expectation was that this year, 6%.
Right.
Especially with the phase one deal and market sentiment improving. That all seemed easy enough.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is, does the government still want to maintain that target? Now, it's a political target and it's important.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to reach that, that suggests quite a strong stimulus.
Yeah.
Now, the tried and tested measures are infrastructure heavy, which is fossil fuel heavy stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
But we're seeing, I mean, the economic structure has changed. Mm-hmm. These transmission mechanisms take much longer. I mean, there's just a very basic question of how much more infrastructure can China build?
Exactly, yes.
It's built roads, bridges, so how much more can it actually do?
Which, as an economy moves, it's going to move from an infrastructure growth economy to a more kind of secondary industry economy, isn't it?
Exactly, to a sort of consumer-led economy, and they've already been doing that. That was the whole rebalancing.
Yes, yes.
But that means that any stimulus will take longer to play out. And if they do this kind of big ticket infrastructure stimulus, again, it's not clear that it can achieve the same effect.
Yeah.
But that also has a downside impact for deleveraging, right? They were trying to de-risk the financial system.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to encourage private companies. And these big ticket spending things usually favor the state-owned economy. And so all of these things set them back on a number of priorities that they have maintained.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, actually, the government's messaging is quite cautious. I mean, yes, reinvigorate the economy, but when the Fed cut rates, the Chinese central bank didn't.
Did not, no.
So they are trying to toe a fine line. I mean, if we will see when the parliament convenes.
Yes.
It was supposed to convene in early March.
Right.
Now, that's been postponed. When they do get into a room together or do it via video conference and convene, they will set out the targets for this year. That's when we will know what the growth target for the year is.
So we don't actually know what the end year kind of growth is going to be, do we? We don't.
No.
You mentioned about the delay of the meeting. What about, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit, I apologise, but what about the drafting process for the 14-year plan? Because, you know, that's critical. It's meant to be happening this year. And I think that's for the period 21-25. Could that be delayed, for example?
I mean, all of these things seem to be delayed, right? We're wrapping up the 13th five-year plan now. The drafting process was supposed to be underway. Again, the parliamentary session, that's one of the kickoff sessions for that.
Mm.
So that planning process is delayed. And it's not just the nuts and bolts of the planning process. It's what are the priorities going to be? If China's looking at supporting growth, what does that mean in terms of reliance on coal, for example, right?
Yeah.
A good trusted source that they have readily available at home. Would they use more of that and forego some of their renewables?
So of course, the whole energy and environmental policies all built into that, and basically the industry and also the world, of course, a lot of players in the world are looking to that direction, and that's just not coming.
Not yet. The five-year plan process is typically a very slow one.
Mm-hmm.
So we get the overarching targets in 2021 and then sectoral targets after that.
Yeah.
But this is a big system, and so it takes a lot of time to get the buy-in of the different actors and inputs. And so all of that is delayed. And so we'll have to wait and see what kind of, A, the timeline, and B, whether the targets are changed now in light of this unprecedented change in circumstances.
I think you used the right word there, Mikhail. It is a very unprecedented, not just in China, but globally, of course. But actually, what I find interesting what you're saying is, you know, the fact that there could be this, or there will be this focus on economic growth to get back to the kind of the GDP targets. But, you know, what could be the impact of that on government policy agendas, including climate change? Because are we going to find climate's put to the back foot again, and we have a focus on economic growth? What do you think?
I mean, it's a bit of a sort of pendulum swings, right? These priorities, they go up and down in importance according to very different parameters. Mm-hmm. Climate change, and, you know, in our discussions, this came up quite a bit, that China was the torchbearer of global climate change up until 2018. Mm-hmm. Now, whether the change then happened because of the US-China trade war and concerns about energy security, or just because the US had left Paris, and so there was less of an impetus. Mm-hmm. So there was already a slightly weaker commitment to China being the kind of, again, the global torchbearer of climate change. Yeah. It doesn't mean that it's not in China's self-interest to continue to tackle climate change.
Right.
It has vulnerable populations, and some of it's not just vulnerable populations, but its biggest cities are on the coast.
Yes.
You know, and they are going to be extremely vulnerable to rising sea levels.
They are.
And air pollution, and we've talked about the difference between air pollution and carbon.
Yeah. So but the air pollution, again, that is the population, of course, going to be saying to the government, we don't want the air population. Yes. So they're actually getting the message, aren't they?
Well, the upside from having 6 weeks of nothing working is that you've cut your pollutant emissions by roughly a third.
So it's a good time to visit China, then.
It is. There are no traffic jams, the subways are empty, and the skies are blue. Even though there was a bout of smog, even during the quarantines, but... yeah, for all the nuisances of big Chinese cities, this is a perfect time to go.
I also think you can get some good deals on the aircraft. But okay, but let's pass on from that. What I'd like to actually, you said something earlier on that I'd like to pick up on, and that is the impact of the supply chains as a result of the shutdowns and the reliance that we've grown to accept of just-in-time delivery orders for different chains. So why don't we talk about the macro and long-term impact of coronavirus? You know, several Western companies have seen, as we know, and you said, the supply chains disrupted, you know, and I'm just wondering, is this going to further challenge a globalized world, if you know what I mean, which we've got so used to?
I think this might not be the straw that breaks the globalization camel's back, mm-hmm. but it's certainly another accelerator in a trend. I think there are two strands to this. One is China specifically and the reliance on China for supply chains. I mean, the trend to relocate away from China, or at least to diversify supply chains, is not new. It's an ongoing process as the cost of labor, land, and energy in China rises.
Right.
The US-China trade war. And it's not just the trade war, of course. It's that whole competition between the US and China.
Yeah.
That's accelerated this process. And I think COVID-19... is again one more element that I think there's a perception, at least in the West, that if China doesn't recover quickly enough, then people will have to move away. Now, there are very legitimate questions as to do other economies have the logistics and the scales that China has?
Mm-hmm.
And for a number of companies that target the Chinese domestic market, they can't move out of China.
But the nationalistic politicians, they're most definitely going to pick up on this, aren't they?
Certainly, and I think that's where it moves away from China and towards a bigger discussion about deglobalization, shutting borders. Now, do companies then, do companies have more fragmented supply chains as they move to sort of Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia, and Europe? Or do they repatriate?
Mm.
Do they try and come back into one region? It feels like there is so much that is going to change now if offices shut down, people are working from home. All our working habits, our traveling habits are going to change. And so this certainly feels like a process that, again, might be good for the energy transition. And I mean, the climate activists have been lobbying for less use of flights.
Absolutely. And let's try it out. Let's try it out. Exactly right. Well, I think you have mentioned this, but I'd like to come back to the securitization of economic relations, because this is actually quite important. And China's industrial aspirations, you know, as articulated in the Made in China 2025 program. How honestly do you think this is going to play out? You know, is this going to have a long-term impact on the structure of China's industry and potentially its growth in the future?
100%. I mean, the Chinese leadership have identified the industrial upgrading as the sort of lifeline of the economy going forward. They can no longer be the low-cost manufacturer of the world, and therefore they're trying to upgrade their industrial infrastructure. The critical thing is, I mean, China can succeed. It has innovative power. It has again, scales to commercialize. Even if the Chinese EVs aren't competitive with Teslas, they can still commercialize them faster than anyone else just because of the size of the market.
Yeah.
The issue then becomes, and this, you know, this goes back to what we were talking about with deglobalization, is the US.
Yeah.
The relationship between the US and China and the securitization of economic relations, that is the thing that's basically broken down between the US and China. Investment and trade used to be the pillars of this relationship.
Yeah.
And that is now becoming a national security concern. And so that is leading to increased competition on technology and innovation. And that, again, will contribute to this sort of defragmentation of global supply chains.
Yeah, interesting. I love the note in your paper, by when you say that the Trump administration has reframed strategic competition rather than engagement. I thought it was very good. Excellent paper, by the way. I urge you all read it. It's soon to be published on the OIS website. Look, you did mention earlier on about the phase one of the targets there. But now China's slowed down considerably, even assuming, a big assumption, I think, actually, after what you said, that there is a recovery later this year. It's going to be impossible, isn't it, for China to meet the phase one import targets. These are the phase one that we're talking about under the US-China arranged deal that was done.
Mm. And again, the discussions were very interesting about this. On one hand, you had the economists and the traders who were, you know, trying to figure out the shifts and the trade flows and how much would you need to move. I mean, at the outset, when the deal was signed in early January, it was highly improbable that China, over the course of the next 2 years, would be able to increase its energy imports from the US by $50 billion. They still signed it. I don't know. I mean, that's the counter-argument. They signed the agreement.
Yes.
And they pledged to do this. But even back then, you know, you're looking at 1 million barrels a day of oil when the peak was 400,000 barrels a day. And the peak was at $50, $60 a barrel of oil. We're at, what, 30 today?
Yes.
5 to 7 million tons of LNG, the peak was under 1 million ton.
Yeah.
And where are gas prices, where are LNG prices today, where were they? I mean, so to begin with, it was very difficult to fathom how that could happen. Mm. Now with China's demand, well, collapsing essentially, and depending on the recovery, we might get a bit of an uptick.
Mm.
But even then, the volumes, it's very hard to see them. And the discussion emerged on sort of two levels. One was, okay, so can LNG markets, are they more fungible than oil markets today in order to redirect the trade flows? But the other side of the discussion was, well, does it even matter?
Yeah.
Does anybody expect implementation of the phase one deal to be perfect? Or was this a political document that was signed because Trump wanted a big number and because both sides needed to stabilize relations? And here we go back to this point about investment and trade being the underpinning sort of stabilizing factors in the relationship. You know, when we were discussing this, we were saying, well, what if China can't implement it? Well, it only matters if Trump decides that it matters.
Exactly. Yeah, it does. It's interesting because, you know, you've addressed kind of the gas and the LNG. And I think I was going to ask you if there are any lessons really that we can learn, because you said the oil, with the cutbacks in China, the oil market was different for the reasons we talked about. So are there any lessons us in the gas sector can learn from what's happened in the oil sector in China?
I mean, when we're looking, I think the oil sector has moved a bit forward in terms of, or has made more progress in terms of privatization and liberalization and allowing new entrants into the market and having a slightly more active and diversified market.
So that's helped them manage potentially the recent changes in demand easier than gas?
It has. It seems as though it has. Again, we have to wait and see how things continue to play out. But in the oil sector, there's been a big response from the refiners. They've cut their throughputs. And there again, there's been an interesting triage between the independent refiners and the state-owned refiners. You know, they are the most sensitive to changes and to disruptions in the market, and they were the first to cut runs.
Right.
But actually, Sinopec, which is China's largest state-owned refiner, took a bigger hit because they have to provide supply security, because they have the product stocks that they now need to export.
Mm.
But it was interesting. I think our sense is, when we look at China, is the independent refiners, the Shandong refiners, would be the first to die in any rationalization, right? We're seeing an oversupplied market right now.
Yeah.
They will be the first to die. They're proving extremely resilient. And actually, the triage suggests that maybe the majors are just as vulnerable, if not more so, than the independents. The Chinese gas market is still very different. It is still overwhelmingly dominated by the state-owned actors.
Yeah.
And we've seen that they were trying to prepare for the Chinese New Year to have enough gas in storage. We've seen the force majeure claims, the force majeure notices that they've invoked on both LNG and pipelines. Now that suggests that demand has collapsed. And not only has it collapsed, you just have nowhere to store.
Well, let's not talk about that, because I just want to let our podcast listeners know that there will be another podcast, which we're actually recording tomorrow, which is going to discuss your forthcoming paper about force majeure in LNG contracts, together with Agnieszka Asson. So let's hold on to that until they listen to our next podcast, if that's okay. What I would like to do, if I can, as we come to the end of this podcast, is kind of ask about, you know, with the slowdown of the China economy, you know, and the wish to stimulate growth, you know, how is that stimulation? What's it going to be, and how's that going to relate to the liberalisation process?
I think everything is going to be stalled. Everything that is not getting growth back, sort of back up and running, is going to stall. Now, for the gas market, privatisation will, in theory, at some point in time, release a lot of pent up demand.
Yep.
But as our discussions and conversations, some of the presentations, highlighted, this is a 2 to 3 year process. They set up a midstream company at the end of last year.
Now that's the CNOGPC, is it?
Exactly, it's the Oil and Gas Pipeline Company, the National Oil and Gas Pipeline Company.
But there's been no unbundling, you know, there's no independent regulator, so there's still a lot to do, isn't there?
There's still a huge amount to do. Even the assets that will be folded into the company, the regulatory, again, the structure of the company, how the asset transfers will unfold, all of that is still to be seen. So over time, this will benefit the new entrants into the market. But in the interim, it's actually giving the majors, yes, they're having to work with each other, which is something they don't like to do. and they're having to, you know, to transfer their assets. But they can also get ready for the next step.
But let's just be clear, so everybody knows that the aim is that the end users, including all the city gas companies, the energy traders, the power plants, they'll all be able to negotiate with suppliers directly and have access to pipeline grids. Actually, so they don't need to go through the big incumbents.
Yes, that is the goal.
So that's a huge threat for the incumbents, but it's good news for presumably lower prices, isn't it? Is that, and they're going to be hubs developed around China? Will that?
In theory and over time, yes. But you know, when we consider prices, how will the asset transfers work? If a pipeline company needs, this isn't Europe where we have pipelines that are pretty much up and running to provide all the markets. This is still a hugely growing market. You need to invest in pipeline infrastructure, storage, regas terminals. China has 140 million tons of planned LNG import terminals through 2023. Somebody has to invest in building them. Now, if that's going to be the pipeline company, can it really ensure low costs as it's trying to develop all
One thing I've learned, I'm not a China expert like you, but one thing I have learned is when China says it's going to do something, there's quite a high likelihood it may very well happen.
That is true.
I always like to end up with the same question. I apologise for that. But, you know, we've covered a lot of subjects in the last 25 minutes or so. So, where's everything going to end up, you know? And aren't there any green shoots in the economy that the gas sector can point to for hope?
I think, unfortunately, this year, it is very much, if there was one word that came up endlessly, it is uncertainty, and that we have to wait and see. Yes, I think, as you very aptly said, if China says it will do something, you'd be very foolish to bet against it. And so if we see a growth target of 5-6%, and if China has, in its 13th five-year plan, a goal for gas to account for, well, anywhere from 8-10% of energy demand, then yes, that could be positive for gas. But that is a huge if, and that will require a very big stimulus that we're unlikely to see right now. So I think the story for gas is still growth, right? This is a 300 BCM market. But if we were expecting at the beginning of the year something like 30 BCM year-on-year growth in total demand, it's probably going to be 15 to 20 now.
Well, Mikhail, not nice news. And as I said, we're recording this, just so you're all clear, on the 12th of March, so you can timeline this with the uncertainty. Thank you very much, Mikhail, for sharing your time. As always, and you know, I really enjoyed our conversation. And Mikhail's paper summarising the messages from the China Programme's China Day will be posted soon.
Yes.
Be posted soon on our website, which is www.oilandgas.com. oxidenergy.org, where you can also find all our podcasts in the multimedia folder and other papers published by the Institute. As always, I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.